those magnificent men. Thinking about flying in the period just before World War I and during the conflict, these were very heady times and most people had only seen balloons fly. There was a good deal of scepticism among members of the public. There was also a good deal of excitement. Flying was sensational. One of the early aviators was Brabazon, who pulled a stunt here in Laysdown to prove that pigs could fly. The first two poems are about this extraordinary event.
Pigs can't fly. Impossible, incredible. A pig so very edible could never fly.
Indisputable, irrefutable, that basket thing, a pig, and winging him off to silence the critics and those that would scoff in order to prove that pigs can fly.
Poor Icarus. What happened to Icarus, the first pig to fly? Such a celebrated pig to have gone up so high.
Well auctioned, then eaten, spit roasted, then sold at exorbitant prices before he got cold at a pub very near here. Poor Icarus.
Once the technology had been demonstrated that planes could actually fly, the public wanted to see how far and how fast they could fly. The most famous race to take place on Chepe was promoted by the wealthy American Gordon Bennett. The first poem is about the excitement of this race, and the second about one of the early aviators associated with Chepe.
The Gordon Bennett race is 1911. At the Gordon Bennett races, you could see the ladies' faces watching young men putting aircraft through their paces on the sunny Isle of Sheppey. The race was won by Charles Wayman in a Newport 11, doing 93 miles in 1 hour 11 minutes.
Cecil Grace. Have you heard of Cecil Grace? He flew early planes from place to place. He was connected to this place at Eastchurch. Died 1910 in a flying accident.
Of course, people needed to learn to fly and a certificate was awarded to those that reached a level of proficiency. The next three poems are about the Royal Aero Club and the very first person on the island to be killed in the process of flying. Last poems convey the excitement of the general public and their thirst for spectacle.
Royal Aero Club Aviator Certificate, a prestigious award indeed, proclaimed the recipient's exclusive rights to Eastchurch Aerodrome and the facilities that they might need.
Samson, Frank McLean, Charles Wells and Cecil Grace, they changed the course of history. They are remembered in this place, especially Grace and Wells, who tragically both expired, their exploits commemorated in lead and glass for generations to be admired at All Saints Church, Eastchurch.
Frederick T. Pullen, on the 10th of December, the year 1910, the Royal Aero Club made an offer to men of the Navy who dared learn to fly, 2 shillings a day for able seamen who would try to become airmen.
T388 Frederick T. Pullen stepped up to the plate. He was single and willing. For the pay of 2 times a shilling, he put his life in God's hand and submitted to his fate.
Unfortunately for Fred, this brave young fella, in 1912 during March, he was hit by a propeller. the first person to die in East Church, they said, from an aviation accident, the propeller crushing his head.
On this island, the name Pullen is still to be found. Even though poor Fred is long gone to the ground, he was buried in Halfway Cemetery.
For years, no headstone proclaimed Pullen's name. No record, no memory, no mention of fame, till someone at some place felt guilty, I'm sure, because the tombstone was erected by some Ministry of War. It was most probably the War Graves Commission in the year 2000.
Those magnificent men, written from information contained in the local newspaper. Read the news, read the news. The cry rang clear. Stunning antics, amazing feats, stupendous daring, enormous courage, little fear.
Gustav Hamel, pilot extraordinary, just recently for Churchill flew. Looped the loop and reverse flying for an hour or two.
Taking off from Grain over Sheerness heated fly, whilst Churchill watched aboard a yacht, amazed, entranced, as Gustav's plane went by. Kamikaze drops, fast turn around, just skimming the surface and missing the ground.
The month of May 1101 and 4, just months before the start of war. That very weekend, folk became aware of Mr. Churchill in a Bristol biplane, hurtling through the air, looping the loop against regulations, rattling windows on houses and shaking foundations. Crowds gathered amazed. Mr. Churchill, is he up there? They gasped and they gazed.
There were two outcomes as a result of that day. The newspapers carried adverts for insurance. People could pay for insurance against flyers and bombs from on high, from biplanes, from airships, indeed anything that could fly.
With imminence of war affair, Winston Churchill worried much. Would the threat be from land or sea? How to find out, how to keep in touch? Gas-filled balloons were all the rage. They gave an aerial view, useful in spotting enemy movements. They could even drop a bomb or two.
The Kaiser's view. The Kaiser too had this in mind. Armed with Zeppelins that could fly as far as London and the English coast, they could worry, attack and even spy.
Churchill's view, this would not do. The Zeppelins must be thwarted. A Royal Naval Air Service must do the deed. Planes built at East Church must be used. Our most daring pilots we would need.
The start of the Naval Air Service. After Mr. Churchill's visit on June the 27th, 1914, came a newspaper announcement that, as a result of rapid consultation, a new scheme was to come into operation. Men would be needed in numbers, you see. For war, it was imminent, and the Navy would need airmen aloft to sight enemy ships, to plot enemy movements and other such trips.
Early flying was a dangerous sport. No pilot would let Winston Churchill fly alone. East Church Aerodrome was where he was taught. The rudiments of flying he was shown. Cargo precious was he such, his wife Clementine worried much. No navigation instruments, no parachutes, no communication system to keep in touch. Eventually, after an accident, Churchill gave up the idea of flying.
Newspapers are a wonderful source. That is, until men began to die in their numbers and the fear of giving information to the enemy called for censorship. The next poems are about early success in the air.
Early crashes from the newspaper account. Lieutenant Hugh A. Williamson, in seaplane number 31, from Grain Air Station, set out on a practice flight. He gave the crew on board HMS Russell a dreadful fright. When wind blew the plane towards the battleship, crashing the plane as the sea hit the craft's wingtip. Unhurt, he quickly scrambled out onto what remained of the plane. From the dockyard bank came a great shout. Their relief was easy to explain.
The first flying politician, Churchill, was determined to get eyes in the sky, but to get the best brains and talents from public schools would mean offering good wages and breaking some rules. It would mean casting the net wide for talent and skill. It would take concerted areas and an iron will. And so the Royal Lady Air Service was born. With special rates of pay, squadron and lieutenant commanders would get £1.05 a day.
In 1915, the war still in its infancy. Hope of an end, a victory, a rout was easier to see, so journalists could pen and promise, could write with excitement and with flair about our pilots' exploits, their missions in the air.
The great air raid, with Wing Commander Sampson at the fore, with Commander Port Courtney and Rathbone. Naval seaplanes numbering 34. The largest flight to leave this shore left journalist and Joe Public completely in awe.
Naval and military pilots both, the most daring, most skillful, sent to plunder, strung out across the skies, a sight of beauty, awe and wonder.
Just as the daylight slowly crept over, travelling like a flock of geese, they crossed the Straits of Dover, heading for the Belgian coast, Dunkirk and the German border. They bombed the railway linking lines that aimed to create disorder.
To stop the Germans in their tracks, to help the Allied counterattacks, in the hope that the enemy would turn back. But their efforts were in vain.
The public views were mixed about the benefits of flying. The next poem expressed various hopes and fears, and also what actually happened. There was much excitement about the idea of actually flying.
I wish I could be. Oh, to be an aviation spotter. Oh, to be an aerial route plotter. High up in the sky, I just gotta join the Royal Naval Air Service.
Early flying. It's cold, it's wet and windy up there. No roads, no navigation equipment, only air. Flimsy, unpredictable flying machines. No parachute, no escape means. Land safely or die. It's extremely hazardous to fly.
Charles Romney Sampson? Who was he? Not some celebrity on TV, but a fearless adventurer, an aviating pioneer who commanded the air station at Eastchurch, not very far from here.
Engaged in experimenting in the development of navigational lights, improvements in the use of aerial bombing sights, long-range radio and night flying, bombs and torpedoes firing. In fact, anything worth trying.
Sampson's greatest claim to fame, the 10th of January 1912, not very far from here, the first ever plane to take off from a ship, determination, skill and guts, overcoming any fear. Yet Samson showed it possible in a Schultz 538, a seaplane fitted with a wooden float. Exciting possibilities it did create.
They had cars. Some pilots had brought cars to the front. They could with these the border patrol. By armour plating them and giving them guns, the enemy might be kept under control. Meanwhile, Samson's airmen made it their mission to bomb enemy planes and Zeppelin sheds and any gunnery positions.
On the ground, their cars probed enemy lines to see what intelligence could be found, aggressively patrolling the territory and to so enhance the chance of stopping the Hun from entering France.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
On May the 26th, Flight Commander Arthur Wellesley Bigsworth, formerly attached to Eastchurch Air Station, was flying off the Belgian coast when he spied a perfect situation. A Zeppelin, fresh from a raid on Ramsgate Town, a pretty target she presented for the crew, four bombs were dropped from 200 feet above, a large column of smoke was seen to ensue. Then, one of the compartments of the airship rose to a height of 11,000 feet. The ship, with its tail down and seriously damaged, her fate was sealed, her doom to meet.
Then in June came the brilliant exploits of Flight Lieutenant R.A.J. Warnford, who destroyed an airship single-handed. After chasing the ship from Flanders to Ghent, he dropped bombs on it, all of which successfully landed. This caused a terrific explosion. The ship was aflame from end to end.
Warnford's plane, flipping, then stalling, with his life in peril, he would have to descend into enemy territory, land, and then restart the plane. Meanwhile, above him, the 28 crew of the German airship were blown to pieces.
Samson in the Dardanelles. By March 1915, No. 3 Squadron, Eastchurch, had left the scene. Churchill saw that the problem in the Med would require aircraft and carriers to go ahead, to spy, to information gather and to intercept. The Dardanelles area must be kept in Allied hands.
The next reading is an actual article from the local newspaper dated February 1915. It is called An Observer's Account and is taken from a letter from Chief Mechanic G. Buds. The letter was addressed to his father, who lived at the time in Minster.
On Christmas Eve, we left a certain point for a trip across the North Sea. Our destination was in the vicinity of Heligoland. Apart from passing a few mines, nothing exciting happened, but at daybreak on Christmas morning, our machine started to give the Germans a shock. I was observer mechanic on Flight Commander Oliver's machine. We had a fine time. Everyone gave us a warm reception in the shape of bullets. But neither the fleet nor the land batteries managed to find their mark, although they were near enough.
When you hear bullets whizzing around in your vicinity, I consider that is quite close enough. At all events, we escaped them all. Not by ordinary flying, though. The pilot was an absolute marvel. He was bringing the seaplane up and down, right and left. In fact, it was all over the place and the Germans could not find the range. I attribute our escape to these manoeuvres alone. After a long flight, during which we dropped our bombs on some military place, we made out to sea and were picked up by a British submarine.
Oh, just fancy Christmas Day. first in a ship through minefields, then on a seaplane over the enemy's fleet and forts, and lastly brought back in a submarine. During the homeward trip, we had a gramophone going with all the latest music. We had chicken, Christmas pudding, custard and jelly for dinner. How's that, Dad, for a submarine in the heart of the enemy's fleet in wartime?
Gilbert Harvey William Buds received the Distinguished Service Medal Award for taking part in the reconnaissance flight on December the 25th, 1914, over Heligoland Bight, including Cuxhaven and Heligoland. He died of pneumonia on the 6th of February 1920, aged 31. He was son of Mr. and Mrs. H. Buds of Sittingbourne and husband of Lillian E. Buds of Warwick Villa. He was buried in Minster Cemetery, Isle of Sheppey, Kent.
September 1915, air accident. Information from the internet, Toronto newspaper. 23-year-old James Morrow Alexander, the pilot's name. Air accident while flying, no one was to blame. Father, Professor W.J. Alexander. Toronto University is where he taught. James had left the shores of Canada. Excitement, flying over the pond, is what he sought.
17-year-old Flight Sub-Lieutenant Keith Johnson's plane crashed into James's on that day. Both Royal Naval Air Servicemen in Halfway Cemetery now lay. Few details of their death are given. Was their death on land or watery? The cemetery records only show that they were held in Sheerness Dockyard, Moultrie.
It took the Toronto newspaper to report the tragedy. Floral tribute from fellow officers, a monoplane. The bodies placed in adjacent graves in Halfway Cemetery. Buried with naval honours, the article read. Much worse for Keith Johnson's father, now his second son, lay dead.
So far, most of the evidence has been found in local newspapers, in cemeteries, from other researchers and from the internet. Books aren't more accessible to the general public. The following account comes from a book of letters written by Harold Rosher to his family. At the time, Harold was with No. 1 Squadron Royal Naval Air Service as part of the Royal British Expeditionary Force.
The date of the bombing raid was 24th of March 1915. There were five pilots involved. Poor weather hampered the operation and only two of the pilots actually managed to reach the target and drop bombs on the submarine base at Hoboken near Antwerp. Courtney and Rosher were the two successful pilots, the others getting caught in the fog or, as was the case for one pilot, suffering engine failure and being interred by the Germans. Next are two accounts by Harold Rosher sent to his father.
As the wind was dead against me, I decided to come round in a semicircle to cross the yards with the wind so as to attain greater speed. I was only 5,500 feet up and they opened fire on me with shrapnel as soon as I got within range. It began getting a bit hot, so before I got quite round, I shut off my petrol and came down with a steep volplane until I was 2,500 feet. When I turned on my petrol again and continued my descent at a rate well over 100 miles an hour, I passed over the yards at about 1,000 feet only and loosed all my bombs over the place. The whole way down I was under fire. Two anti-aircraft in the yards, guns from the forts on either side, rifle fire, mortars or machine guns, and most weird of all, great bunches, 15 to 20, of what looked like green rockets, but I think they were flaming bullets. The excitement of the moment was terrific. I have never travelled so fast before in my life. My first impressions were the great speed, the flaming bullets streaking by, the incessant rattle of the machine gun and rifle fire, and one or two shells bursting close by, knocking my machine all sideways, and pretty nearly deafening me.
3 days after the date of the last letter, Harold was killed. On the 27th of February, Major risked the CO of Dover Aeroplane Station being away on duty. Harold, as second in command, was in charge. Among other duties, he had to train new pilots on fast machines, and he would always personally test a new machine or a newly repaired machine before allowing anyone else to try it. On that Sunday morning, he ordered a number of machines to be brought out the shed for practice flights. Among them was one which had just been repaired after a mishap 3 weeks earlier. The pilot already got into his machine. Harold told him to get out as the machine was untested, and himself took it up for a trial flight of 8 or 10 minutes. Everything seemed to go right until Harold began to descend about a mile away from the aerodrome. Then, at a height of 300 feet or less, the machine suddenly made a nosedive and crashed to the ground. Harold was killed instantly.
Oh, the grave of Harold Rosher is in Charlton Cemetery, Dover. Buried here on the island is yet another hero, whose grave lies mostly forgotten. John Douglas Hume died in 1916 and is buried in Halfway Cemetery. He was posthumously honoured by the King in 1918.
London Gazette, 17th of May 1918. Honours for the Royal Naval Air Service. The King has been graciously pleased to approve the award of the following. For services in Mesopotamia, to receive the Distinguished Service Cross, Flight Sub-Lieutenant John Douglas Hume, RNAS, since killed, for continuous good patrol work, artillery spotting, feeding nut LMRE, etc., sometimes making 3 trips a day under all weather conditions. He invariably displayed great coolness and resource in the face of enemy, regardless of personal danger.
The Siege of Kut El Amara. The Siege of Kut El Amara, 7th of December 1915 to the 29th of April 1916, also known as the First Battle of Kut, was the besieging of an 8,000 strong British Indian garrison in the town of Kut, 160 kilometres, that's 100 miles south of Baghdad, by the Ottoman army. In 1915, its population was around 6,500. In April 1916, No. 30 Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps carried out the first air supply operation in history. Food and ammunition were dropped to the defenders of Kut, but as often as not, their parcels go into the Tigris or into the Turkish trenches. The relief effort had failed at a cost of around 30,000 Allied killed or wounded. Ottoman casualties are believed to have been around 10,000.
The death of John Douglas Hume, DSC, 10/12/1916. Killed whilst flying, drowned, in short 184 seaplane number 9054, dived into the sea from considerable height whilst on patrol near Tongue. W.E. Bradley, DSM, also drowned. The Distinguished Service Cross, this gallantry award of John Douglas Hume, awarded posthumously, is granted in recognition of gallantry during active operations against the enemy at sea.
Harold Rosher and John Douglas Hume were just two of the very many pilots that had connections with Eastchurch and the Isle of Sheppey. It would be impossible to name all of the pilots and observers that used the island as a base. Many of those involved in flying during the early days did not live to old age and are buried in far-flung places. It is to celebrate their memory and bravery that we have come here today.